Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're going to talk about three legislative issues that are making waves in Montpelier and around the state this week. Later in the hour, we will look at retail marijuana and then minimum wage increases, which will move forward now that the legislature has overridden Governor Scott's veto. But first, land use and development. Middlebury Representative Amy Sheldon chaired the Commission on Act 250, which was charged with coming up with a proposal for how to update Vermont's Development Act for the modern era. The committee had done a lot of work prior to the start of the session last year, and Representative Sheldon spoke to us in November of 2018 about some of the things that needed to be addressed in a new iteration.
So Act 250 was really forward-thinking when it passed, but we weren't talking about climate change. We didn't understand the importance of our large forested areas and the connectivity that wildlife needed, so habitat fragmentation wasn't on the books. We have developed regional and municipal planning. And so there's just been a lot of big things changing that also work towards meeting the goals of Act 250. So we want to take this moment to make sure that we're looking to the future to address climate change in all of its aspects and also integrating it so that it is as efficient and predictable. That's what the regulated community, the folks who apply for the permits, want us to do also in this charge.
All right. So the committee shared its ideas. The House took it up last year and a bill emerged. The bill that passed the House Natural Resources Committee this month caused quite a stir, with some people loving the changes and others expressing a lot of concern. The bill then went to the Ways and Means Committee, and what is coming out of that committee looks very different. Here to explain the twists and turns and where this legislation is headed is VPR's John Dillon. John, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Jane.
So, you know, we heard Representative Sheldon there talking about some of the new developments that the creators of Act 250 either weren't focused on or couldn't have anticipated back when Act 250 was created. Before we get to the changes and you know, all of the ways that this is sort of being negotiated and debated, can you just remind us fundamentally what Act 250 is supposed to do?
Absolutely. You heard Chairwoman Sheldon talk about how it was a forward-looking bill, and it certainly was for 1970. It says that major developments, and that definition has changed over time, but big projects should be evaluated for 10 broad social and environmental criteria. Emphasis on social, because it's not just an environmental review. It's how do these projects fit in with the municipal plans, with the character, the look of a community. So projects are evaluated for their impacts on water resources, air quality, traffic, growth and development, you know, which can take into like what's the impact on schools, and all of that. But it was a 1970s era law.
Lots of things don't look so good now that were popular in the 70s.
Well, we're not driving cars from 1970, and this bill is showing its age. As she says, there was really not concern about climate change back then. Vermont back then was really experiencing a surge in growth and development that was sort of unchecked. There was not a lot of local zoning. There wasn't a lot of wastewater regulations. This is like pre-Clean Water Act, you know. I mean, it was a wild landscape out there, and so the bill was set up very broadly to look at all these impacts. But since then, things have changed. You know, we are concerned about climate change. We are concerned about resilience for flooding. We are concerned about forest fragmentation, for example. So that's what they were trying to do. And then there's complaints, as she referred to, about the process, the alleged inconsistencies in decisions, the length of time, the expense. So they were trying to address all of these things in modernizing the law.
I mean, there are also just changes to the ways that we build our societies and our cultural priorities. And, you know, those need to be reflected, too, in a change 40 years on from.
I mean, sprawl is one big area of concern that wasn't around back then. Plus, a lot of communities now have zoning, so which wasn't the case. So, yes, there was a need to update it.
All right. So there was a an acknowledged need to update it. And as we heard, Amy Sheldon chaired the committee that was charged with looking at what might be done. And then that went to the legislature. And last year, not all that much happened. So it sort of needed to happen this year. So describe what was in the first iteration of the bill that passed the House Natural Resources Committee earlier this month.
Before I get to that, I have to explain what happened over the summer briefly, which is that a leading environmental group, the Vermont Natural Resources Council, and the administration of Governor Phil Scott got together and basically struck a deal. And that deal became the template for what the committee dealt with. And we can talk about what was in that in the committee bill. But essentially, it really did a lot in terms of streamlining the review process. The district commissions initially, and there's nine of them that do the initial review, were eliminated under the first version. That review was then assigned to a professional board. Later on, two members from a local region were added to satisfy some of concerns about lack of local representation. So it did that. It put the review in the hands of a professional board rather than a citizens panel, and it eliminated one appeal stop. So appeals under this previous version would have gone straight to the Supreme Court instead of the Environmental Division of Superior Court.
And that was basically to cut down on delays in development.
Delays, and then the professional board aspect was to satisfy the argument or address the concern that there are inconsistent decisions coming out of district commissions. There is never a whole lot of data on that point, but it was – you kept hearing it over and over again as a driver for this change.
So those were changes that developers would like, and it sounds like maybe the Scott administration was in favor of. What other changes, though, were in that – in
well,
this first
so
version?
Because it was a compromise, it also included some additional protections for unfragmented forest lands. It added a new trigger for Act 250 jurisdiction for upper elevation areas, which was something that environmentalists, VNRC, really wanted, and it exempted developments from designated downtowns from Act 250 review, which is pretty much everybody wants, particularly as we're facing a housing shortage.
All right. You said, John Dillon, this was a compromise plan. This was, you know, hashed out in some parts of it in the summer before the session even started, but not everybody was happy with this compromise. In fact, a lot of people were very unhappy with it.
That is very true. So the negotiators of this deal were obviously – thought they had a great package. But there's a whole community of Act 250 believers out there and who say this process has served the state of Vermont really well. The citizens-based nature of Act 250 is being gutted. They made their voices known, and these included former district commissioners. I was getting emails from them, people who worked in Act 250. They were testifying, lawyers who had been in the trenches of Act 250 cases, both for developers and for interveners, all said, bad idea. So it then went to Ways and Means. The committee, Natural Resources Committee, voted it out somewhat reluctantly. If all of the committee members had been there, it would have been a 6-5 vote. So very close. Happened on a very snowy day, so a couple of people weren't. But it goes to Ways and Means, and Ways and Means committee chair there, Janet Ansel, doesn't like it. And she says, okay, no money for this change. No money for the change, because they have to approve the fees.
Right.
So she doesn't approve the funding mechanism. That committee does not. So all of a sudden, a 94-page bill goes to a 50-page bill. And that's what we're sort of looking at now. It goes back to the status quo for the initial stage of review, back to the district commissions. Appeals still go to the Environmental Division. The forest protections are in there. The downtown provisions are in there. But there's no money, and there is great concern among state agencies who have to conduct and provide the expertise for environmental reviews that this is going to be a whole lot more work to review an impact of a project in an upper elevation area. Who's going to pay for the biologist? So that's a whole other issue that's going to come up later on as we get down to the nuts and bolts of how it's going to be paid for.
So, in fact, some people are saying, you know, not only has it eliminated the sort of streamlining process, but it actually might cost us more because the things you have added are now going to be more expensive.
Yeah.
Plus, again, I'm coming back to this thing that we've talked about, John. This was a compromise. So if the compromise is no longer there, you know, what are the chances that this will see administration support? I mean, where does this go now?
Well,
you've described it as a moving target, Act 250 legislation.
It is very much a moving target. And, you know, it's rare that you hear House members and prominent people in the House saying, well, maybe the Senate can fix it, because that's sort of really passing the buck legislatively. But I'm hearing that with this. So maybe the Senate can fix it. Well, that's a bit of a cop-out legislatively, I think. But anyway.
Well, not only that, but even if the Senate, quote-unquote, fixed it, it would still have to go back to the House. So then what happens?
And, well, first you asked me about the administration. They do not support what is coming out now. And they're looking to, they say, it's a long, you know, legislature is not over. Crossover is in another week or so. So when bills have to pass from either chamber to the other, and, you know, they say it's still got a ways to go, and they're looking to make some changes.
If you were a betting man, I mean, what do you think is actually going to happen here?
Oh, boy. I don't think the Senate is in a great mood to do a huge lift on this thing to make all the changes that the administration wants at this stage, especially after almost, you know, 2 years of the House trying to deal with it. So I don't think they're in the mood to clean it up. So I would say you might end up with components. This is another scenario. Components of this bill scattered in other bills, like the forest land provisions. The money question is a big one. I'm not sure how that's going to be resolved. If I were a betting person, I would say as conceived in this compromise, probably won't happen.
I'm now distracted by thinking about maybe they could make some changes to the proposed sports betting bill to include people being able to bet on legislative action. And, you know, what would the odds be and how much money could they generate for that? John, before we let you go, while all of this is happening, there are also changes occurring in the administration of the state's environmental policy agency. Emily Bodecker abruptly resigned at the end of last week, and Peter Walk is now the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation. What's up with all of that?
I don't really know why she resigned so abruptly. Peter Walk was Deputy Natural Resources Secretary and the point person for the administration on a number of hot issues, including this one. So he's doing the Transportation Climate Initiative. He's leading the charge on that for the Scott administration and Act 250 overhaul. He's still the point person on that, but now he also heads a 300-person department.
And he was a proponent of the changes that we talked about that were originally in the Act 250
bill? Right. He was the negotiator for the administration on that and jointly presented it with VNRC in the beginning of the session.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about your reporting and seeing what happens with Act 250. John Dillon is a longtime reporter for VPR who focuses especially on agricultural and environmental issues. John, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome, Jane.
Today, House lawmakers are debating a bill that would create a way to tax and regulate the production and sale of cannabis in Vermont. The bill passed the Senate last year and has been making its way through the House since January, getting tweaked and changed along the way. Of course, even if the bill passes the House, it still has to go to Governor Phil Scott, and the governor has been vocal about three key points he would insist on for such a bill to get his signature. Here he is in November of last year.
There were a number of conditions that I put forth and communicated early on, and that was about roadside testing, more education for our kids, as well as an opt-in type of proposal for communities that either wanted or did not want a regulated market in their communities. So beyond that, I mean, there's always technical aspects, but those are the three conditions.
Again, that was Governor Scott in November of 2019. And here to tell us what's been happening lately with the Senate's retail marijuana bill as it makes its way through the House, and if the latest version of the bill could pass muster with the governor, are Xander Landon, a reporter covering politics and the State House for VT Digger, and 7 Days reporter Colin Flanders, who covers the State House and the weekly paper's Cannabis Beat, or Cannabeat. Colin and Xander, nice to have you both with us in our Montpelier studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Now, of course, we are live here in the noon hour on Wednesday, and there's actually action on this today. Xander, what's happening this afternoon with this legislation?
Yeah, so it took about a year, but that's, you know, basically last September the House received this bill from the Senate, and after much deliberation and committee work on this legislation, there's going to be the first floor vote on the bill today. So this is going to be the main vote on this legislation in the House. It's really going to give us a sense of how much support it has and whether it would be able to withstand a veto from the governor. And you know, it's likely that we're going to see a lot of Democrats, likely the majority of Democrats, voting in favor, and a handful of Republicans as well, who believe that now that, you know, we've seen partial legalization of marijuana in the state. Essentially, it's legal to possess and grow it yourself, but it's not legal to sell it. That it's now time to a lot of Republicans now also agree that it's now time to sort of carve out a way for there to be legal sales and for dispensaries to open up in the state. So, you know, that vote is going to be coming on the House floor this afternoon, and then there's going to be sort of another formal vote tomorrow, and then likely after that, we're going to see disagreements on the legislation and this policy being worked out between the House and the Senate in conference committee. And once those are worked out, it'll go to the governor's desk. There are a bunch of sort of sticking points in the legislation that are likely going to have to be worked out, namely on whether to and how to legalize roadside saliva testing, which is a provision that a lot of people say needs to happen if legalization is going to be expanded to legal sales.
Xander, the way you framed it there, that sounds like it's pretty cut and dry. Quick vote today, quick vote tomorrow. But it also sounds like there could be a lot of discussion today and tomorrow, and perhaps some amendments. So it doesn't sound like it's quite as, you know, simple and like moving on to the next step as it might seem. Why not?
No. Well, there are a lot of concerns, to, you know, varying concerns that people have about the legislation. One is sort of – there are sort of granular discussions about, you know, where revenue should go, what should be funded with this revenue from legal sales. There's different opinions on the tax rate. The House had passed over the House had changed the tax rate that the Senate had put in the bill, increasing it from 16% to 20%, and also changing what, you know, sort of where the taxes are going. There's no longer a local option tax, which a lot of people in the House are likely to be concerned about. That would basically give towns the ability to raise you know, sort of collectively across the board, millions of dollars to do things like implement, you know, improved law enforcement, or, you know, other sort of local initiatives to fund those things, along with, you know, dispensaries opening up.
But the local control piece is still in there, right, Xander? So, you know, the governor mentioned in that bite that we heard, we want towns to be able to say yes or no. You know, no, we don't want to have a retail establishment here. What's taken out is there's no ability to have a local option tax on retail cannabis, but you can still say not in our town?
That's correct. Towns would still have the ability to essentially ban dispensaries from coming in. What was taken out was the provision to allow them to raise tax money, individual towns to raise tax money from the sales of marijuana in those towns. And that was sort of nixed in favor of having more money come into the education fund to sort of, I think, in part to help fund a universal after-school program, which the governor wants and pitched this year in his budget, and which lawmakers like as well. And it's also an initiative that would satisfy one of the governor's criteria if he's going to support legalization, and that he wants to see programs to help prevent youth drug usage. And obviously, after-school programs, a robust universal after-school program would definitely address that.
Let's go to Alan, who's with us from Burlington. Hi, Alan. Go right ahead.
Hi, I maybe am very late to the party with this idea, but it seems like
you know, I'm just saying, as a person who I would see dispensaries on the corner, personally convenient, but not something I want in my neighborhood any more than I want another liquor store. Mm. And I just wonder if we couldn't get more benefit to the farmers by requiring that you could only sell product that you've grown yourself.
Alan, thanks for that. Colin Flanders, you've been looking at this agricultural aspect, and Alan is saying, you know, what if the state only allowed locally grown marijuana to be sold here? Can you talk a little bit about what it looks like right now in terms of how the legislature is addressing that question of who can grow, how much they can grow, and how that then goes from a farming operation to the retail operation?
Yeah, that's a good question. So currently, the House version of the bill and the Senate version of the bill have what's called a cannabis control board that they'll be setting up. And it'll be deciding a lot of these granular points about how many licenses there are and things like that. I think currently the legislation only really mandates the size of what's considered a craft cultivating license, which would be currently 500 square feet. There's an amendment that will come up today to maybe expand that into 1,000. And that would sort of cut the bureaucratic red tape for some people who want to do it, as the name suggests, more as a craft than a large-scale grow operation. I think one of the biggest concerns about limiting who can jump into the market is that if the state really wants to try to combat some of the black market that exists today, you need to make it so that people can join without too many barriers. I recently wrote a story about the farming question, and the House Government Operations Committee changed some language to sort of declassify cannabis as an agricultural product, which opens the door for a lot more local control. And so that's why you might hear some concerns about some farmers and small-scale growers coming up, is that they don't want too much local control because they feel like towns that don't want cannabis to come there will make it very hard for them to jump in the market. Yeah.
And Colin, to be clear, I mean, when we talk about regulations or potential regulations for craft growers of cannabis that is being sold, you know, for this particular part of the marketplace, you know, that has THC in it, very different from the regulations for hemp growers who are growing a similar plant, you know, the same plant, but with a much different purpose.
Yeah. So, that question really sticks to the farming issue, and currently a lot of farmers have sort of transitioned into hemp growing with the idea that they may one day be able to pivot to growing cannabis with THC. And the concern is that now if it's not an agricultural product, they may run into some more barriers at the local level, where if you're on land that's not zoned agricultural, but you take advantage of farming exemptions that are given to hemp growers, will you be able to also grow marijuana? People just don't know. And I think it's that level of uncertainty that's worrying a lot of people, especially farmers who need to be able to plan how they're going to stay relevant in the next 5-10 years. The conversation around the cultivating licenses for craft growers is just to really make it so that people who want to get into the market and want to have small-scale grow operations don't have too many barriers.
Before we leave this topic, we do have another thought and question from Phil, who emailed in to say, I'm in support of a tax and regulate market and would hope a craft marijuana industry similar to our craft beverage would improve tourism in the state. In my opinion, it's important these dispensaries are owned by residents of Vermont and not state-owned or owned by out-of-state, quote, big marijuana businesses. And Phil asks, what are some reasonable regulations that have been successful in other states or cities to ensure that a tax and regulate market would benefit Vermont-owned small businesses? Colin, I'll start with you, and then Xander will come back to you on this as well.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So some of the reporting that I've done on other states is really focused on how they've been dealing with the question of local control versus the craft cultivating licenses. And I think that's because Vermont has a very healthy craft culture, if you want to call it that. And I think a lot of small-scale growers right now point to the way that craft beer has really exploded over the last decade or two, and really think that the cannabis market should mimic the steps that have been taken there. But I think this is a question that a lot of states are grappling with, between allowing people on the ground to get up and running, but also recognizing that it is a business and there will be some interest from out-of-state companies, and it's trying to strike a balance without making it too difficult for anyone.
And Xander, you know, are lawmakers crossing the border and looking at what's been happening in Massachusetts as Massachusetts works on how to have a regulated industry and how retail operations have been going there? I mean, are they checking out other states that are states like Maine, perhaps, that are sort of struggling to figure out how to have a retail industry? You know, how much are we looking at other states?
I think that there has been testimony taken from other states. I can't speak specifically to what regulations in those states look like, but I know that lawmakers have looked particularly at Massachusetts and how the market there has been quite a corporate one, with out-of-state companies coming in and setting up shop, and a lot of people who sort of had hoped for a more local marketplace sort of rising up in Massachusetts sort of being disappointed. And one of the biggest things that lawmakers point to in this legislation to sort of show that they're trying to ward off just sort of a corporate takeover of the market is limiting the number of licenses that individual companies can receive. Basically, that a company that comes in and does this can only receive one license to grow and one license to sell. And that's sort of one of the main things that's pointed to, in addition to the steps that they are taking to ensure that there are some small growers and small farmers that are also going to be able to participate in this market. Like Colin suggested, a lot of the small farmers and the small growers still are not assuaged by what the steps that have been taken and want to see more.
Let's go to Spencer, who's with us from Killington. Spencer, what's your take and where are you coming at this from, and any questions you have?
Hi, yeah, I'm a former dispensary worker. I worked in the Vermont medical dispensary industry for about 4 years in Vermont. And, there's a lot of people in my position that would want to get into the industry again. And with S-54, we don't really see a good bill for us, for, kind of the normal everyday Vermonters. You know, a lot of it was written by the medical dispensaries that are currently operating. They get a head start. And we don't really feel that's a level playing field for people that want to get into the industry. It's not really a fair shot. The other point I wanted to make, too, is about the roadside saliva testing and impairment. It's really tough to judge what actually constitutes impairment when you're talking about cannabis. And also, when you're having someone taking a saliva sample from you without a warrant, presumably on the roadside, that kind of opens up a lot of civil liberty questions. What is that going to be used for? How is that going to be stored? Can they sequence your DNA from it? And a lot of that kind of stuff hasn't been answered. And I think there's still a lot of uncertainty about this bill.
Yeah, Spencer, thanks for your thoughts and perspective there. And, Xander, that is one of the big questions. As we've heard, it's been a major sticking point for Governor Phil Scott, who would be open, he said, to a retail establishment as long as this idea of roadside testing was in the bill. But as Spencer points out, a lot of other people are very concerned about what might this mean for civil liberties. You know, how do we actually make this work? Is there anything that can actually work effectively as a roadside test? Where do things stand currently on that?
Well, there is currently no roadside saliva test in the country or anywhere, as I understand it, that can effectively tell the person administering it whether the person receiving the test is actually high or impaired at that time. What it does show is the presence of marijuana or other drugs in that person's system. And obviously with marijuana, that's a drug that can stay in your system for weeks at a time. And so in theory, you could be given the test and have smoked, marijuana or consumed it 2 weeks prior, and you're going to still show a positive test. And so that is a big concern for Democrats, particularly in the Senate, the civil liberties concern there. And basically, they have been very resistant to agreeing to a test or legalizing a test that would basically, as they see it, isn't scientifically effective. And in the House has been generally supportive of legalizing saliva testing, but sort of realizing the Senate's concerns, they made it a requirement that, okay, we're going to do saliva testing, but there has to be a warrant requirement in place. And so essentially, an officer would have to have evidence and get a warrant in order to administer that test. But the governor and his administration, they don't like that warrant requirement because they're saying, well, that's effectively the status quo. Mm-hmm. Right now, if you want to get a blood test to test your impairment, you're going to have to get a warrant for that as well. And what the governor wants to see is more public safety initiatives on the table, particularly this test, so that police are better equipped to address high driving and impaired driving. So he has sort of come out and said pretty loud and clearly about 2 weeks ago, I can't support this legislation unless you can do the test at the roadside without a warrant. And so it'll be really interesting to see today's vote, whether there's any chance they'd be able to do this without his support, without his signature or letting it become law, or whether the governor is going to show any indications in the coming weeks that, you know, maybe I can support this, soften that approach, because this in and of itself could be what stands between whether we see a legal market in the state or not.
Yeah. Let's go to Julie with us from South Burlington. Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a few questions surrounding this potential new legislation. Number one, I'm wondering, what is the driving force for legalizing marijuana? Is it more of an economical aspect from a consumer's perspective? Because I've only really known of it to be, or its presence wanted from a medical standpoint, which I do support, providing that you have a card. And my other question is, having teenage children, I'm not in support of dispensaries being in my community, however, or any other. However, I'm wondering, is there going to be a legalized age of 21 of any customer purchasing this marijuana from dispensaries?
Julie, thanks for the questions. And let's tackle that second one first, because that's in some ways much more straightforward. Colin, what about the legal age requirements for purchasing marijuana from a retail establishment?
Yeah, so this bill would be setting up an adult use market where you would have to be 21 to purchase any cannabis products.
And again, as we talked about earlier, as it currently stands, there still is an opportunity for towns and municipalities to opt out of having a retail establishment in their community. But, you know, Julie's going back to this fundamental question, which in some ways I think some people might say, look, we already litigated this. We've already got legalized cannabis. But, you know, Julie is still saying, I'm still not quite there on, you know, having cannabis for non-medical purposes. Do you see, Colin, other people in the state, you know, as we have this conversation about retail establishments and a tax and regulate system, sort of questioning again the validity of legal cannabis?
Yeah, I do hear that. And I think that's where lawmakers have found themselves trying to thread the needle here between people who were very comfortable with prohibition and didn't see a reason to legalize it in the first place. Meanwhile, there's also people who've been ardent supporters and feel like Vermont should have legalized a full market from the start. Because right now, I think a lot of people argue that we're in the worst case scenario where it's legal to possess and grow, but it's not legal to buy. And that is really fueling the black market. And I think one of the main reasons that people want a market here is that it does provide some health benefits in that you have a better idea of what you're purchasing. Right now, if you go out and you purchase from a black market dealer, you don't really have any idea what's in that. If you set up some regulations and have some things that require words on, like, for example, what you're purchasing, how much THC is in it, there's rules that can dictate the levels in that, you have a better idea of what you're consuming. As far as the tax revenue goes, I think that is obviously a motivation for some lawmakers. Anytime you can get some money, it's a good deal. But I think there is there's not been as much projected tax revenue as I think some people had hoped. I think the middle ground right now is around $10 million in the or once it's about 5 years up and running. And so I think it's a mix of all these motivations, while understanding that, as even the Attorney General here in Vermont has said, it's just the worst case scenario in the system we have.
You know, it's interesting. Colin was talking about that idea of having things funnel through a regulated market and the benefits of that potentially for both labeling and having people understand what they're consuming, but also, of course, for the tax implications. But Xander, it's not a guarantee that having retail establishments means there's no longer a black market, or that cannabis sales are automatically going to occur through that regulated system, right?
Yeah, that's right. In other states that have done this, it's taken a while. It's taken, in some cases, years before there's a serious dent made in the black market. In Massachusetts and California, which legalized both about 2 years ago, the black market is still really raging. It makes up 80% in California of all of the sales, marijuana sales that are taking place. That's, you know, despite the dozens of dispensaries that have opened up in the last 2 years in California. And in Massachusetts, it's about 75% of sales of cannabis that are taking place still on the black market. And some people say, you know, that are sort of analyzing these marketplaces, that it just takes time for the legal market to establish itself. Others say that it's really important in sort of combating the black market to have a tax rate that is not too burdensome or not too high, so that people see value in going to dispensaries. Because, you know, if you have a high tax rate at the legal dispensary, people might see, you know, the prices higher there and not want to basically spend more money at a dispensary than they would have to on the street. So these are all sort of things that lawmakers have been taking into consideration as they're crafting these this legislation.
So Colin Flanders, despite all of these open questions that remain, do you anticipate that we will see a retail establishment bill actually go all the way through to the governor's desk?
I do believe we'll see it go through to the governor's desk. I think the big question, as Xander laid out very well, is what happens there? Mm-hmm. And I think everybody is sort of holding their breath to see.
All right. Well, we are also holding our breath, and I appreciate the two of you coming on to tell us where things stand right now. As we go live in the noon hour, we're still anticipating some conversation and a vote later today in the House. So I appreciate both of you coming on during a busy work day. Xander Landon is a reporter covering politics and the State House for VT Digger. Colin Flanders covers the State House and the Cannabeat for 7 days. Colin and Xander, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
One more legislative update before we end the show today. As you probably heard, the Vermont House successfully voted to override Governor Scott's veto of a minimum wage bill yesterday. The Senate had already voted to override, but the tally was expected to be more uncertain in the House. In the end, the House had just enough votes to override. But the minimum wage increase to $12.55 by 2022 is lower than what many supporters had originally hoped for. April Barton is a reporter for the Burlington Free Press. She covered the House's override vote, and she joins us now. April, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Can you describe what happened yesterday with the House vote?
Well, yes, it was a pretty exciting day because, as you know, we've been seeing Governor Phil Scott veto bills. We saw before the paid family leave.
Yeah.
He vetoed that one. That one failed by one vote to be overridden. And so the fact that this one passed, it was very exciting and passed just enough, as you said in your intro, by the 2/3 majority that was needed.
All right. So the minimum wage increases will now move forward because the legislature has overridden the governor's veto. And the wage increase will go from $10.96 today to $11.75 in 2021 and up to $12.55 by 2022. But then what happens after that? Because obviously the idea isn't that it stays $12.55 forever. But so, April, what happens after 2022? Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, from that point on, there's expected to be a 5% increase each year, which is about the rate of inflation. But also, if the federal minimum wage ever exceeds the Vermont rate, then the U.S. wage would be used. And it's interesting because in 2021, it would have been 55 cents lower than the $11.75 that it will now be. And in 2022, it would have been $1.08 lower. So there are actually significant difference between what was expected for 2021 and 2022, now that it will be $12.55. But that's quite a bit lower than the $15 that was originally proposed that didn't make it through before.
Yeah, you know, it is a far cry because $15 and $12.55, you know, when you average that out on an hourly basis over the course of the year is a lot of money in somebody's pockets. In terms of legislators, do you get a sense that people are happy that this $12.55 legislation is moving forward, or do you think it feels like a lot of hard work and frustration for perhaps no one to actually get what they really originally wanted?
Yeah, I think it's a compromise. Like you say, I think there were a lot who wanted the 15, but then on the other hand, there were some Democrats who voted against it because they thought the 1255 was going to be too much for employers to be able to bear in Vermont, and that it would be too much, you know, undue financial strain. So there's a variety of thoughts about this issue. And so the 1255 is a pretty good compromise.
How has the governor responded to this?
Well, he, as you know, did not want it to pass because he is looking for the trying to look out for, you know, workers and or employers in Vermont who this might affect negatively if he feels like it may be an arbitrary raise, you know, increase in money that they're able to spend right now. And so he's not happy, but of course wants the best for Vermont going forward.
April, I want to clarify one thing as we go through this, because, you know, this idea we keep saying of 1255 by 2022. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what applies to tipped workers and others who might have a different kind of pay structure?
Right. Well, for service or tipped employees, it actually raises it to one half of the state minimum wage. So when it gets to 1255, it's going to be more, you know, like 627 or somewhere around there for the service or tipped employees, which that includes employees of hotels, motels, tourist places, and then your restaurant servers or anybody who, the way the bill is written, it's who customarily receives more than $120 per month in tips. So those people, yeah, will get half of the state minimum wage. Yeah, and then I don't know if you wanted to talk about agricultural workers.
Yes, please.
Yeah, so the rate is still the same for them, but what I found interesting in the bill is it requires a report from what other states have done and how they've handled tip earners and then also agricultural workers. So they're looking at how they have been impacted by wage and hour laws in other states. So Vermont can learn from what has happened there in case there's any changes going forward, but also specifically the Fair Labor Standards Act and other federal employment laws as they apply to agricultural workers. And then there's also a report for service and tipped employees to see how their jobs, prices, and the state economy have been affected for them and their welfare for tipped workers and specifically women and families that are tipped employees.
You know, April, you mentioned earlier that the governor has said he thinks that this may place an undue burden on employers who could struggle with this increase in the minimum wage. When we look at workers, you know, it's always good to have more money in your pocket. Nobody's going to say that that's a bad thing. But for workers who will be seeing $12.55 an hour in 2 years, but look at that and say, that's still not a livable wage. You know, are you getting a sense of how this feels to workers who may be saying, great, more money, but I am still really going to struggle?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what I've heard. And I think one of the biggest issues is affordable housing, and people look at that and it's like, yes, that's helpful, but I don't know that that's going to help me buy a house. Maybe I'll be able to eat a little bit better. I think they're happy, but it's not going to change everything in their lives.
Yeah. That's April Barton, a reporter for the Burlington Free Press, who covered the House's successful vote to override Governor Phil Scott's veto of a minimum wage increase. April, thanks for talking with us today.